This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 8th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, in Haiti, quake survivors call for stable tents and adequate shelter ahead of this spring's rainy season. We'll go to Southern California, where a nuclear power plant is under scrutiny for skipping seismic studies. And farmers and environmentalists in India are protesting what could be the first genetically modified crop in the country. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Pennsylvania Democratic Representative John Murtha died today. He was 77. The outspoken critic of the Iraq War was the first Vietnam combat veteran to serve in the United States House of Representatives. Congressman Murtha headed the House Appropriations Committee for two decades. In 2005, Murtha called for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Murtha's congressional career was also tinted by ethics concerns, from the 1980s Abscam matter to questionable earmarks for defense contractors. Murtha died following complications from gallbladder surgery. Troops in riot gear patrolled Indian-administered Kashmir today and warned residents to remain inside in an effort to thwart a planned demonstration. Shahnawaz Khan is in Srinagar.
Authorities placed most of Kashmir's top separatist leaders under house arrest and detained others today. Separatist leader and chief cleric Mirwais Umar Farooq had called for a march to the Srinagar office of UN Military Observer Group in India and Pakistan to protest human rights violations. From his cordoned house, Umar called for the UN to intervene in the Kashmir dispute. Today's restrictions were mainly meant to prevent the demonstration. Heavy rains and the unofficial curfew kept most residents indoors. Today is the fifth day of curfew-like restrictions in Srinagar. But Kashmir first shut down on Monday last to protest the killing of a teenager shot by a police tear gas shell. Last Thursday, authorities imposed an undeclared curfew to quell growing protests. The next day, another teenager was killed allegedly by paramilitary troops. None of the paramilitary stations nearby have admitted responsibility, but the police are investigating. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Afghan officials in Helmand province say that as many as 35,000 people are fleeing the city of Marja before a military offensive expected to begin in a matter of days. Marja has the largest population of Afghans living under Taliban control in southern Afghanistan. NATO forces leafleted the area over the weekend, warning of the impending action. All of the employees of a power plant in Connecticut are now accounted for after an explosion there killed five people on Sunday. An investigation into the blast at the Clean Energy Systems plant in Middletown began this morning. The accident at the partially built power plant happened during a test of natural gas supply lines. In Sri Lanka today, a recently defeated presidential candidate and former army chief was arrested for sedition. FSRN's Ponia Manikavasagam reports.
The arrest of Sarat Fonseca came as a shock to many opposition party politicians. One of his allies who witnessed the arrest said the former army commander and his assistant were forcibly dragged to a vehicle by military officials. Just hours before the arrest, Fonseca told reporters that if there is an international inquiry into war crimes during the nation's 25-year civil war with the Tamil Tigers, he will testify.
I am definitely going to reveal what I know, what I was told, and what I heard. Anyone who committed war crimes should be brought to the courts.
Sarath Fonseca and President Mahinda Rajapaksa were once strong allies. Together they fought to defeat the Tamil Tiger rebels and end the decades-long civil war. But they fell out and Fonseca quit the army. He then fought a bitter election campaign. He was defeated. He claims the election was rigged. The government alleges he was plotting a coup. Ponnaiya Manikavasagam, FSRN, Sri Lanka.
Costa Ricans easily elected their first female president yesterday. In her acceptance speech, former Minister of Justice Laura Chinchilla said that crime, violence, and drugs remain the greatest challenges facing the Central American nation. Chinchilla does not support the right to choose abortion or gay marriage, but does support the welfare policies of her party, the National Liberation Party. She's vowed to continue the free trade policies of her predecessor and to increase funding for security by 50%. Voters in New Orleans elected the city's first white mayor in 31 years. Mitch Landreau commanded 66% of the vote to succeed two-term mayor Ray Nagin. Landreau campaigned largely on a platform underpinned by high crime and stalled efforts to rebuild the city after Hurricane Katrina. And in presidential elections in Ukraine, a very narrow margin separates the apparent winner, opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych, from his rival, Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. The elections have been called fair by international monitors. Barring a contest to the outcome, Yanukovych is now poised to replace the man that defeated him during the Orange Revolution, sitting President Viktor Yushchenko. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dori Marina in New York. The rainy season is looming in the earthquake-torn country of Haiti. A light shower fell throughout Port-au-Prince last night. For thousands that were left homeless and living in makeshift tents across the country, the need for adequate shelter is urgent. FSRN's Dolores M. Bernal has more.
For many Haitians living in cardboard and cloth tents, the rain last night was distressing and a reminder of days to come. Jean Michelle Angel and her five children live in a tent city on the foothill in Delma.
Sometimes we stood up, sometimes we sat down. We didn't know what to do when it rained. It was very difficult for them. When it rains, there is some water down on the ground, but we don't know where we can go. We're very afraid and scared when it rains.
Angel is just one of thousands of survivors living in tent cities in Port-au-Prince, which range in size from 50 to 5,000 people. There are dozens of these camps in parks and empty lots, on sidewalks and along the roads. Very few people have received tents and tarps to protect them from the rain. Bretan de Gilles is a father of three children who is also living at a tent city in Delma. He said that when the rain started to fall last night, he began to pray.
We pray God to stop the rain because we didn't know what to do. What to do? We got only Jesus. We were obliged to pray God stop it. And after a few minutes, we stop it.
The rainy season begins in May, and hurricane season lasts from July to October. The country is no stranger to floods and strong winds. Three hurricanes have struck the island in less than 2 years. USAID, along with many other relief organizations like the Red Cross and the UN, are in charge of distributing shelter to the survivors. But getting such aid to survivors, along with that of food and water, has been slow. FSRN attempted to speak with USAID representatives at the U.S. Embassy in Haiti about the steps they are taking to ensure that most of the survivors will have a tent over their heads for the next storm. USAID declined to talk to the press about the issue because of, quote, lack of authorization, unquote, to speak about the tents in particular. But Edmond Mulet, UN's interim head of the stabilization mission in Haiti, told FSRN last week that the distribution of tents is urgent. Mulet.
Well, the most urgent situation right now is assistance to the population that has no food, no water, no shelter. And a rainy season is coming, so we have to provide them with tents. This is absolutely fundamental. This is the most urgent thing.
Until sturdier tents are distributed, many Haitians continue to make do with tents made out of bed sheets, cardboard, or plastic. Angel says she knows many people have tents and hopes to get one somehow.
We need tents. We need several tents, but we don't know where we can find them.
More rain is in the forecast for Haiti this week. Dolores M. Bernal, FSRN, Port-au-Prince.
Washington is attempting to dig out from the storm that dumped more than 2 feet of snow over the weekend. The snow has closed the federal and local governments today as streets are still covered in snow and public transportation is limited. The Senate was supposed to begin debating legislation to create more jobs today, but now the Senate isn't expected to meet until tomorrow afternoon. Joining us to talk about the upcoming week in Washington is FSRN's D.C. editor Leanne Caldwell. Leanne, what is in this jobs bill that the Senate is supposed to take up sometime this week, weather permitting?
Well, the jobs package is supposed to be a series of bills that the Senate plans to roll out throughout the year. The first measure was supposed to be debuted today, but they're blaming it on the snow that lawmakers had to get out of town Thursday before the storm approached. But another reality is that two Democrats and two Republicans are coming together to create this proposal, and they have a lot of questions to figure out. They have to figure out how to pay for it, how large it's going to be, how to move forward, and, of course, what's going to be in it. And they have not come to a conclusion yet, to be frank. What it is likely to be is a series of tax cuts and incentives for small businesses to get them hiring again. It's supposed to be much smaller than the stimulus that passed last year. And with the hope of having Republicans on board, it's likely not going to have infrastructure funding or project funding to put money into the economy. Instead, it's going to expect it to be more on the side of tax cuts.
Now, the jobs bill isn't the only thing delayed in the Senate. President Obama's nominations are as well. Can the snow be blamed for the holdup?
Not this time. Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama is holding up 70 of Obama's nominees. He's a Republican, and these nominees run from the non-controversial everyday nomination to some people who are controversial. But it has nothing to do with who's being nominated as to why he's holding these people up. Instead, it has to do with politics and pet projects for his state. Senator Shelby wants an FBI counterterrorism lab to be built in his state, and he also wants Northrop Grumman to receive a major defense contract for air-to-air refueling tankers. That would provide hundreds of jobs for his state.
Well, is there any other option for them to pass these nominations?
The option is that they could reach a deal. Senator Shelby can get what he wants, and then he'll let go of the hold, or some other deal can be made. A final option is for the president to recess appoint these nominees. That means that when the Senate is out for recess, which they will be next week for the president's day break, the president can push these nominations through and just appoint them himself. The only catch is that these nominations will only be good through the end of the year instead of for their full term. Many of these terms last 4 or 5 years, so they would have to be renominated next year.
And any possibility we'll see progress with health care reform this week?
Well, last week, speaking to Democrats, President Obama told them that they need to take their time and be deliberate when dealing with health care. Many people saw that as a sign as the president was giving up on health care reform amid these new realities of a 59-seat Democratic majority in the Senate. He received a lot of criticism for that. Yesterday, he, in an interview with CBS's Katie Couric before the Super Bowl, he took an initial step on how to move forward on health care, and he invited Republicans to the White House for a meeting. Here's what he had to say.
How do you guys want to lower costs? How do you guys intend to reform the insurance market so people with pre-existing conditions, for example, can get health care? How do you want to make sure that the 30 million people who don't have health insurance can get it?
So President Obama is using his politics and has invited Republicans and Democrats to a meeting at the end of February for a televised meeting. And that is how he says they will move forward on health care reform, to see if they can come up with any compromise or negotiations and see if the House and the Senate can move forward.
Right, I see. That's FSRN's D.C. editor Leanne Caldwell. Thanks, Leanne.
Thank you, Dorian.
Visit us online at fsrn.org to check out today's web extras, hear extended interviews, and see pictures our reporters send in from the field. Get a glimpse at fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. I'm Dorian Marina in New York, and you're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Stay with us. The Obama administration has signaled interest in nuclear power as part of a solution to the nation's energy needs. But groups say that the plant relicensing process is in need of attention. They say that public safety and fiscal responsibility could be getting overlooked. James Aramayo reports from Central California, where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is scheduled to host public meetings on the relicensing of two reactors at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant.
The Diablo Canyon Power Plant is located in Avila Beach, 12 miles southwest of San Luis Obispo, a Central California city with a population of about 43,000. Its twin 1,100-megawatt reactors are capable of generating more than 18 million kilowatt-hours of electricity per year. Diablo Canyon supplies power to more than 2 million people annually. Activist groups have long opposed the plant. The San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace is one such group and is made up of individuals living in the vicinity of Diablo Canyon. Jane Swanson is their spokesperson.
Mothers for Peace since 1973 has been very active regarding safety issues at the Diablo Canyon plant, so this is our main focus. And the record at Diablo Canyon is not so great.
The plant was also the site of a historic demonstration. Over a two-week period in 1981, police arrested more than 1,900 anti-nuclear protesters. Nearly three decades later, activists continue to raise concerns about the plant. And now plant operator PG&E is seeking to renew licenses for the two reactors, even though the company is currently licensed to generate power until 2024 and 2025. David Weissman is outreach coordinator for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, based in San Luis Obispo.
On November 24th of this last year, PG&E filed an application with the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And people in the state are left with a dumbstruck expression on their faces and, huh?
The Alliance takes issue with PG&E's apparent attempt to make an end run around the state of California's relicensing process by applying directly to the NRC for relicensing. If PG&E were to go through the state relicensing process, it would have to comply with AB 1632, a statute requiring seismic studies of a new earthquake fault and its possible effects on the plant. While Diablo Canyon is designed to withstand a 7.5 magnitude quake, watchdog groups are still not convinced that is enough to ensure public and plant safety. In 2008, the U.S. Geological Survey discovered a new fault, dubbed the Shoreline Fault, located offshore within a mile of Diablo Canyon. Again, David Weissman.
When an earthquake fault is ignored, it ends up costing the ratepayer money. Whether it was the Hosgreave Fault that was ignored at Diablo Canyon, you know, starting in the 1960s and 70s, and then ended up costing over nearly $2.5 billion to repair, or the fault in the Niigata, Japan region that shuttered and closed down the Kashiwazaka plant for several years, only to have partial recovery now at a cost of billions of dollars. At a time when the California government is so strapped for cash and will need energy, can that many megawatts of power be entrusted to be in one very fragile bowl?
The Alliance also takes issue with the $85 million charge that PG&E would like to bill ratepayers to underwrite the costs of the relicensing application. Groups are also concerned with the NRC's role in relicensing the plant. Swanson with the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace says the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not take public safety seriously enough. Again, Jane Swanson.
We're trying to nudge the NRC into being more responsible and to put more weight on public safety and less weight on corporate convenience.
Swanson also argues the NRC has relaxed its standards to make it easier for aging nuclear power plants, like Diablo Canyon, to get relicensed.
Everything that matters, like earthquakes, waste storage, transportation of radioactive waste, all these huge issues are fenced out. They don't matter in the bureaucracy that the NRC has created.
Swanson says the one-size-fits-all approach to maintaining safety doesn't work, and they want the NRC to examine site-specific safety issues more carefully. The NRC has scheduled public meetings Tuesday as part of Diablo Canyon's relicensing process. When contacted for this story, an NRC spokesperson would say only that the purpose of the meetings is for the NRC technical staff to explain the process they will use to review the licensing renewal application for Diablo Canyon. PG&E did not respond to requests for comment. If the relicensing application is approved, Diablo Canyon would be authorized to operate until 2044 and 2045. The NRC has never denied a plant relicensing request. James Aramayo, Free Speech Radio News.
Supporters of a 34-year-old Iraq war veteran say the U.S. military will be extraditing him to Iraq to face a military trial for a song he wrote called Stop Loss. Mark Hall spent 14 months in Iraq and was due to end his military contract at the end of this month, February. Instead, like thousands of other soldiers, he received a stop-loss order that would continue his active duty and send him back to Iraq. So Hall recorded and released this song as a form of protest, he says, and mailed it to the Pentagon. But success got cost, the army got forced, telling me like me is stop lost. That song has now landed him in jail, where he faces charges in violations of the Uniform Code of Military Conduct. Hall could be extradited, according to his supporters, as soon as this week. To discuss this case, we're joined by attorney David Gespas, president of the National Lawyers Guild and founding member of the Military Law Task Force. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First, just to be clear, you have had contact with Mark Hall, but you do not represent him in any official way at this point.
That's correct.
So what exactly are the charges that are being brought against Mark Hall by the military?
There is one charge, one additional charge, is violation of Article 134 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That was also the original charges. And they are a number of specifications, all of which have to do with communicating threats. And apparently to various and sundry people, I've seen the charge sheet, but they redact the names of the individuals who were allegedly threatened. But the charges all have to do with communicating threats to other members of the Army.
And what is the reason for moving him overseas? I mean, why can't he be tried in Georgia or the U.S.? I mean, what's the reason for him being moved?
Well, I suspect that the Army would make different claims about the reasons. My guess is they would say that that's because that's where all their witnesses are. From my perspective and from talking with Mark briefly and talking with his military lawyer briefly, the real reasons are that makes it more difficult for him to get witnesses, because who is going to want to go to a war zone to testify? And it also separates him from his supporters. I think, in essence, they are taking away his right to a public trial, because even though the trial over there would be public in the sense that anyone who happened to be in the neighborhood could walk in, none of his supporters would be able to attend. And that, to me, really seems to be the essence of why they're doing it.
Now, this case also brings up the policy of stop-loss. President Obama said that stop-loss should not be used. Secretary of Defense Gates, now, didn't he say in 2009 that the policy was ending or being phased out?
I believe he did.
So why are we seeing this now? Is this kind of the ending of that policy? Or
My feeling about it is that it's very, very difficult for them to prosecute two wars without keeping people in. We've had a discussion over the years in the Military Law Task Force about whether or not a draft is likely to be reinstated, and my feeling has always been that it's not likely to be, because the modern military requires a lot of training, because there's so much technology involved in war fighting in ways that avoid actual combat face to face, where you look your enemy in the eye. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that they don't have sufficiently trained people without getting people who've been in for a while. And again, we're fighting two wars now.
And this policy, we're not talking about just a few people. I mean, according to the Iraq Veterans Against the War, the stop-loss orders have stopped about 185,000 soldiers from leaving the military since 2001. So very briefly, what's the next step in the case of Mark Hall?
Next step would be, assuming he's sent over there, that there'll be motions filed, one to get him back to the United States for trial. There will be motions concerning, I think, the right to a public trial. And then at some point, the military judge is going to set a trial date, trying to get witnesses over there on his behalf if the trial is over there, and trying to defend them without witnesses if they can't.
Attorney David Gespas is president of the National Lawyers Guild and a founding member of the Military Law Task Force. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Department of Defense and military spokespersons in Iraq did not respond to requests for comment by deadline. Farmers and environmentalists in India are protesting the government's plan to introduce genetically modified food in the country. The groups have stepped up their campaign after a government committee recently recommended a transgenic version of the popular Indian vegetable eggplant for commercial release, declaring it safe for human consumption. The government is holding public meetings to decide whether or not to allow the country's first genetically modified food crop for cultivation. From New Delhi, FSRN's Bismillah Galani has the story.
At a public hearing in the northern city of Chandigarh, Environment Minister Jairam Ramesh tries to pacify a huge gathering of angry farmers, consumer groups, and environmental activists. The minister has been traveling to various parts of the country to gauge public opinion on genetically modified crops. The response has been the same almost everywhere. People are outraged. The genetically modified eggplant, known as BT Brinjal, is being promoted by the Maharashtra Hybrid Seed Company, or Mahico, the Indian partner of the US agrobusiness giant Monsanto. Opponents say the government has recommended approval of genetically modified eggplant without evaluating health and environmental risks. Radha Kapuria is a member of the Coalition for GM-Free India.
There has been independent studies done by scientists, not just in India, in other countries as well, and it has shown how Mahico's own report is showing negative impact on the rats who were fed BT Brinjal. But the government bureaucrats have just not acknowledged that there was organ damage. That has just been disregarded by the expert committee too, which approved the BT Brinjal.
Mahico says the seeds have been altered to be pest resistant, which will benefit both the farmers and the consumers. But this claim is being contested by the environmentalists, who see genetic modification as a threat to the biodiversity of food crops and the soil health. Rajesh Krishan is a campaign manager of sustainable agriculture at the Greenpeace India.
India being a center of origin and center of diversity of brinjal, if a genetically modified food crop with a bacterial gene comes in, that's going to destroy our 2,500 varieties that the farmers have developed and so much more of wild germplasm that we have. The second concern is the impact on non-target organisms, be it microbial organisms in the soil or non-target insects, friendly insects and so on and so forth.
Krishan and others are also concerned that brinjal will pave the way for other GMO crops.
BT brinjal is a door opener. If BT brinjal gets approved, all the 55 other crops which are under different levels of genetic engineering will move in no time. So our entire food system will get genetically modified.
The government is expected to announce a final decision soon. Meanwhile, a group of scientists have also joined the protests, demanding a moratorium on the release of BT brinjal seeds until the biosafety concerns are addressed. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Today's headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Scott Pham and Antonio Ortiz. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.